the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Big controversy in Great Britain as the Archbishop of Canterbury made a rather amazing statement in a public address given just about a week ago. He announced that some elements of Sharia law, that is, of Muslim Islamic law, would eventually, and he said inevitably, become a part of British life. In other words, he is foreseeing a parallel legal system with Sharia law, that's Islamic law, pertaining in some neighborhoods and some enclaves and some cities, whereas the rest of the citizens will be held to a secular law. Now, this has led to calls for his resignation. It has led to an unsettled relationship between the Crown and the Archbishop of Canterbury. It has thrown his already confused church into worse confusion. But it has also led to a fascinating question, and that is, what sane proposal could come whereby we would propose to allow Islamic law in Western societies, even if the argument goes it's just for Islamic people in Islamic neighborhoods, those who follow the teachings of Islam? We'll be talking about this today, and we'll also be looking at what I call the false hope of the left-wing intellectuals. And we're going to be looking, for instance, at liberal Christian theologians who think that the way out of all of this is to develop liberal Muslim theologians. We're going to look at why that's a bad argument and then why it won't work anyway. When we get to that conversation in just a few moments, to join us, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. First, to review some issues in the news, at my website at albertmohler.com, I posted two articles overnight. One of them is a means of getting to the lectures I gave at Dallas Theological Seminary last week. I was honored to give the W.H. Griffith Thomas Lectures in Theology at the historic Dallas Theological Seminary. The title of my lectureship was Atheism Remix, the New Atheism as a Challenge to Christian Theology. Now, Dallas Theological Seminary has the lectures in audio and video form up for free at their website, and you'll find the links to all four of those lectures at my website at albertmohler.com. And it was a great honor to deliver that lectureship, and I do hope you will find those interesting. The New Atheism is a significant challenge to us, a challenge to Christian theology, and both in that lecture format and in a forthcoming book, I'm dealing with that question, and we'll be dealing with it in conversation here on this program in coming days. At the New Scientist, that is a British science journal, there is a celebration of Darwin published by Michael Zimmerman. Michael Zimmerman is behind Darwin Sunday. And just in case you didn't know, last Sunday was, in at least some churches, Darwin Sunday. That is the Sunday closest to Darwin's birthday, when those who are pushing the evolutionary agenda within especially some Christian churches or churches that claim an historic tie to Christianity, seek to make that point on a particular Sunday. Now, so far as I know, Darwin Sunday is not picking up as a major ecclesiastical observance. It certainly is probably not something that was even talked about in your church, but in some churches it is. But the reason I'm dealing with this today is because in his letter on Evolution Sunday, his article published at The New Scientist, he brings me into his argument. This is what he says. He says, back in America, things are no better. In November, Chris Comer, longtime director of science curriculum for the Texas Education Agency, was forced to resign after circulating information about a presentation critical of intelligent design. In May, the Christian organization Answers in Genesis opened a $27 million creationist museum-cum-theme park in Kentucky, which attracted a quarter of a million visitors in its first 6 months. You're supposed to hear, by the way, as I interrupt this reading, approaching hoofbeats of ignoramuses that are refusing to go along with the evolutionary worldview. I pick back up in the article. He says that approximately 45% of Americans continue to believe that God created human beings pretty much in their present form at one time within the last 10,000 years or so. Fundamentalist religious leaders pushing a creationist agenda regularly assert that the faithful must choose between their religious beliefs and evolution. Evolution is regularly caricatured as being incompatible with belief in God. Albert Mohler, president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, has stated that one can't be a Christian and believe in evolution. This is particularly dangerous because I believe that most people, if forced to choose between religion and evolution, will select religion. He says this is the reason why he started Darwin Sunday and his clergy letter project back in 2004. Now, just a clarification here. I did not say, nor did I ever write, that one cannot be a Christian and believe in evolution. I have written, and I have said, and I will stand by my argument, that one cannot be a consistent Christian thinking Christianly and be a consistent evolutionist thinking in terms of the dominant theory of evolution and hold those two things together simultaneously with integrity. It is impossible. You cannot have a designer and a non-designer. You cannot have the presence of meaning in the universe and no meaning. It's simply impossible. You can't reconcile these truth claims. But what's really interesting to me is the paranoia behind the evolutionists in all of this. They simply can't believe that even now, the majority of Americans simply won't go along with this. But you really see the paranoia here at the end when they say this is particularly dangerous because, and this again is Michael Zimmerman writing at The New Scientist, he says, I believe that most people, if forced to choose between religion and evolution, will select religion. You see, that's exactly why there is such an agenda to try to make it appear plausible that the theory of evolution can be reconciled with belief in God and even with Christianity. And it can be, so long as you redefine God, so long as he is not the personal agent of creation. It's perfectly plausible so long as you redefine Christianity so that it is no longer tied to the authority of the Bible as the revealed word of God. Because if you are going to accept evolution in any sense that's compatible with the dominant theory now in the evolutionary academy, then you're going to have to accept as the front door of the entire equation that there can be no supernatural intervention at any point in the process. Which means, as Stephen Hawking of Cambridge University says, if God exists, there's nothing for him to do. Now, you may square that by claiming that you have some belief in God. You may even claim some allegiance to Christianity. But if you believe there's nothing for God to do, and that there can be no supernatural intervention or design in the process at any point along the continuum, then you are not a biblical Christian. There's simply no way to come to any other conclusion, I would argue, if you read the Bible and if you understand evolution. But it's interesting, again, to see, because you can see exactly what they're concerned about here when Mr. Zimmerman writes, if people have to choose between religion and evolution, they will choose religion. It is Valentine's Day, of course, and happy Valentine's Day to all. Some are deciding that perhaps it's not a holiday they want any part of. Nancy Gibbs, writing in Time magazine, this week's issue, says that it's a day to forget because she says it really advertises a false ideal of romance. The idea that romance is something that can be scheduled, that romance is something that just automatically happens, that romance is something that's transactional. Instead, she says, falling in love is a very different experience. And she also bemoans something that is, I think, important in here when she talks about how it teaches children, and perhaps young girls in particular, some very false and injurious things about what their expectation of romance and love should be. Well, I don't know how much Valentine's Day means to you, but it means a great deal to the American economy, as it comes right along behind Christmas and Halloween as primary celebration events, and right behind Christmas as a major gift-giving event. Very, very interesting to look at all of that and realize what's going on. Also, at my website at albertmuller.com, I posted an article last night on the book The Defining Moment by Jonathan Alter. It's about the first 100 days of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's administration. And I think anyone interested in leadership should look at this book, because Jonathan Alter, who, by the way, is a senior editor at Newsweek magazine, is looking at the fact that Herbert Hoover really was an intellectual. He really did understand the realities of the problem. He just didn't understand leadership, and thus his was a failed presidency, according to Alter. Along comes FDR, and let's face it, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's one of the most controversial figures in American history. But one thing is clear, he did understand that what was needed in the minds of Americans was a president who would act. And so a flurry of actions and a flurry of words followed his inauguration, especially in those first 100 days. And it literally did transform much of America in the process. It is interesting that this book also it is really something that you can enjoy, whether you really enjoy FDR or not. Well, it was a big win for the Beagles at the Westminster Kennel Dog Show. Listen to this.
superb, beautiful lineup. Thank you very much. May I have the Beagle?
Yes, the Beagle!
For the very first time, a Beagle won the Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show, a 15-inch Beagle. A cause for rejoicing for all Beagle owners and Beagle lovers, such as, well, myself and my family and our household companion, Baxter the Wonder Beagle. Back for discussion about Sharia law and Western civilization and why a Christian leader would suggest that at some point it simply will be inevitable in our own countries. The phone number 877-893-8255, coast to coast and with listeners around the world. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. The Archbishop of Canterbury is a senior cleric in the Church of England and the titular head of the Anglican Communion worldwide. Whenever he speaks, he gets press attention, especially in Great Britain, but also around the world, because he represents one of the largest communions of Christians. It is, of course, one of the most historic roles in institutional Christianity, and the current incumbent as Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, previously served as an academic theologian before being elevated to this role. Since he's been in the role, he has been a stackpole for controversy on at least a number of issues. As a matter of fact, one of the key complaints about him is that often when he speaks, no one has the slightest idea of what he means. He tends to write in academic jargon. He tends to speak with such convoluted phrases that when he addresses controversial issues, no one seems to understand exactly what often he's saying. The problem is he gets in more trouble when he is understood on many of these issues. His church, of course, is involved in fractious debates, most centrally over the issue of biblical authority and homosexuality, but now also over the issue of Islam in British society. Now, remember, just as a matter of historical reference, that the Church of England is an established church. It is the Church of England. It is the official state religion of Great Britain. Unlike the United States, which largely in response to Great Britain and also to continental Europe, there is no and has been no federal, that is, national state church. In Great Britain, the Church of England is indeed the Church of England. Church of England lessons are taught in the what we would call the public schools in religious instruction. The Church of England has an official role within the government. Historically, the bishops of the church have had seats in the House of Lords and thus involved in governmental legislation. The Archbishop of Canterbury has a very important national role. Now, if you are not familiar with what's going on in Great Britain in recent decades, you need to know that that country, small as it is, that little Emerald Isle, that cradle of much of Western civilization, has been in an experiment in ridding itself of its own heritage and its own national identity. If you go to London, you go to Birmingham, you go to Durham, to York, to many of the cities, especially in the north of London, you will notice a massive number of Islamic immigrants, and in particular, a large number from Pakistan. And these Muslim immigrants have established, as they have throughout other major cities in Europe, separate enclaves where they tend to live in concentrated areas in some parts of Great Britain. As one senior Anglican cleric warned just a few weeks ago, there are now some no-go zones where if you're not Muslim, you really do not want to enter those zones. A lot of intimidation, according to the bishop. You have a great deal of Islamic symbolism and activity. You have the prayer towers, and you have the calls to prayer several times a day, often broadcast at very high level, high decibels of amplification. And now you have the Archbishop of Canterbury. Now remember, the head of the Church of England, an historic Christian church, saying that the recognition and operation of Muslim law in some parts of Great Britain is now inevitable. This has led to a firestorm of controversy. As a matter of fact, it's led to widespread calls for his resignation, calls from the left and the right. This may be the one issue that all of a sudden has united persons across the ideological spectrum, both within his church and within Great Britain. A lot of folks here in the United States are beginning to scratch the head wondering what in the world is going on over there, because even as this issue is being debated in Great Britain, there are some similar questions to be raised even in some parts of the United States. But not as right now in Great Britain, and certainly not as occasioned by the Archbishop of Canterbury's suggestion that Sharia law in some way, in some places, is inevitable in Great Britain. The address was given. It was entitled Islam and English Law, Civil and Religious Law in England. And I'm going to read to you from part of the text of the Archbishop's message. You need to hear this. He says this: "This lecture will not attempt a detailed discussion of the nature of Sharia, which would be far beyond my competence. My aim is only, as I have said, to tease out some of the broader issues around the rights of religious groups within a secular state, with a few thoughts about what might be entailed in crafting a just and constructive relationship between Islamic law and the statutory law of the United Kingdom." Okay? So far, it sounds like a very strange address for the Archbishop of Canterbury to give. But nonetheless, if that was his aim, he missed it, because that's not actually what he did. Instead, he suggested that the possible use of Sharia law to resolve some civil matters is something that should be considered. He says this, and this is the kind of speech the Archbishop is given to. He says, quote, "There may be ways of engaging with the world of Islamic law on something other than an all-or-nothing basis." In other words, just the civil law or just Sharia law, maybe both. Now, just as a point of historic reference, this was tried some time ago, very recently, in Quebec. It led to a near disaster. You see, there are calls by Muslim enclaves that say, let us handle these issues, let us decide what marriage is, let us handle divorce, let us handle financial controversies and debates, conflicts among Muslim people, let us handle a lot of things. Now, Sharia law is itself not something you can just find in a book. It's not a codified law. It is, instead, the application of the principles of the Quran. And from country to country, in Islamic society to society, you will find it applied differently. Throughout the Middle East and much of North Africa, you will find countries that maintain a dual system of secular courts and religious courts. The secular courts deal with things like murder, robbery, embezzlement, and the church courts or the religious courts, the Sharia courts, deal instead with issues related to marriage and inheritance and other things like that. Saudi Arabia and Iran have only one system. It's all Sharia law. And if you are familiar with how that works in both of these countries, you will know that that means extreme punishments, physical punishments, sometimes even the amputation of limbs. It means sometimes a public execution. And it means, for instance, that the Western standards for the necessity of evidence and testimony are not necessarily required in order for the Sharia courts to reach their verdict. In Afghanistan and Libya and in the Sudan, you have selected laws, Sharia laws, applied within the civil code. And especially in Africa right now, big controversy when some areas, some states in Nigeria have allowed some imposition of Sharia law. Now, the Archbishop of Canterbury wants to make clear he is not calling for the imposition of a Saudi Arabian kind of Sharia law. He wants instead to suggest that there might be a way of allowing Muslim courts something like what they have, these Islamic courts, something like what they have in some other parts of the world, which is a limited jurisdiction over issues of marriage, over issues of the more intimate areas of life, and maybe some issues of financial conflict as well, inheritance in particular. Now, this raises a huge question. It certainly raises a question about the identity of Great Britain as a society. The interesting thing about the Archbishop is, and this is what's really of interest to us, is that he seems to think that this might be a way out of some potential conflict. If you can just find more liberal Muslims, we might call them what the people in the British press want to call them, moderate Muslims, who agree to a moderate Sharia law, maybe that would be a good compromise. Now, when we come back, we're going to consider why a more liberal Christian theologian would think that developing and encouraging more liberal Muslim Islamic theologians just might be a good idea. And we're going to consider why evangelical Christians are going to have to look at that very, very differently. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. This is the Albert Miller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. Ruth Gledhill of The Times, that's Britain's most influential establishment newspaper, put the issue this way. The headline of her article was, "Has the Archbishop of Canterbury gone bonkers?" Typically British way of saying, he's lost his mind. That's what a lot of people are beginning to wonder in Great Britain. But the Archbishop is sticking by his guns, saying that his proposal simply makes sense. Speaking on Radio 4 in Great Britain, speaking to the program The World at One, he had this to say.
Nobody in their right mind, I think, would want to see in this country the kind of inhumanity that's sometimes been associated with the practice of the law in some Islamic states, the extreme punishments, the attitudes to women as well.
Well, you know, very interesting there, and he's not going to get much argument about that. The argument is not about what Britain wouldn't want. It's about why he would want the imposition of some Sharia law in at least some neighborhoods and enclaves in Great Britain. He says nobody in the right mind, you heard him say that, would want to see in this country the kind of inhumanity that has sometimes been associated with the practice of law in some Islamic states. Let's just get to the worldview shift, the worldview conflict that is at stake here. I mean, Western jurisprudence is established upon a Christian understanding of the human being as a moral agent. The human being as a responsible moral agent who should answer for any wrongdoing, but with certain protections, because we also understand that the court is made up of fallible, sinful human beings. And thus, Western jurisprudence, the Western system of law, is intended to provide a way of establishing, insofar as it is humanly possible, the guilt or innocence of an accused person. And this means that the accused person is also understood to have certain rights. These were developed over history in Western civilization. We are the inheritors of common law. We are the inheritors of the development of this kind of legal understanding so that we don't put people underwater until they bubble to find out if they're witches. Instead, we have a system of laws that have protections. We have due process. We have a requirement of evidence, the requirement of testimony, so that we're trying to reach a verdict. And the limitations upon the court are as important as the limitations upon the citizen. The court has to go through the evidence. The court has to decide which testimony is legitimate. The court has to follow written standards of law. It can't just respond to its moral intuitions. Now, Sharia law is very different. Sharia law is like where perhaps the West would be had the Christian worldview in terms of the understanding of the importance of the human being as a responsible moral agent not founded a transformation in the law. This transformation has never happened in Islamic cultures. Instead, you have, certainly in countries such as Saudi Arabia and Iran, this mixture of secular and religious concerns, secular and religious courts, in Sharia law. Now, what Rowan Williams seems to be saying, the Archbishop of Canterbury, is we can have a little bit of Sharia law. We won't let them cut the hands off of people for stealing. We won't allow the stoning of homosexuals or walls to fall upon them or be pushed upon them so that they're crushed to death. We won't allow what he calls here the extreme punishments. He also says he's not going to allow the extreme attitudes toward women. We're going to have to return to that in just a moment. But he says maybe we could come up with some areas of the law that would be more appropriate for the Sharia courts than for the British secular courts. He's had this to say as he was explaining the point.
I think I'm simply saying that there are ways of looking at marital dispute, for example, which provide an alternative to the divorce courts as we understand them. In some cultural and religious settings, they would seem more appropriate.
Now, that's very, very interesting. And it really does get to something that's being discussed in this country as well. It's a parallel argument. It's not the same argument. The parallel argument is this. You hear some debates over same-sex marriage, and boy, we're light years from talking about Sharia law there, but we're talking about same-sex marriage. You hear now some people, both in the secular circle and also some who are speaking as Christians, saying maybe we need to have a secular understanding of marriage and a religious understanding of marriage so that the state simply sees it as two people who make a pledge to one another, regardless of gender. And the church then is free to say, well, we accept this as marriage, but none other. But the interesting thing is, of course, that no one is suggesting that the church court ought to be able to decide for Christians in terms of a civil understanding who is and isn't married. That's a big difference. That's a big jump. Whereas in Great Britain, if the Archbishop of Canterbury has his way with this proposal, there would be the way for Muslim courts, Islamic courts, these Sharia law courts, to make that decision on behalf of many, presumably British citizens. Back with more in just a moment on the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. I want to tell you why it's important for us to discuss this. Number one, it is a major controversy right now in terms of a Christian church, in this instance, the Church of England in Great Britain. But it also has to do with how we understand Christianity and the law. And, for instance, you know, in the United States, you have a very clear inheritance from Britain of the common law. You have a very clear inheritance from Europe of the understanding of jurisprudence, of due process, of evidence, of testimony, of juries. You have a very clear sense of codified protections for the individual. And let's face it, sometimes our frustrations as a society are that there appear to be too many protections, that the exclusionary rule excludes too much evidence, that there are too many people who are presumed that we all know would be guilty, who seem to go free or plead to a lesser sentence. And there's a frustration there. Let me just ask you to evaluate that frustration over against the frustration of a legal system in which the individual lacks those protections. You know, this is a particularly pernicious proposal coming from the Archbishop of Canterbury. It's particularly, I think, unthinkable and grotesque coming from the head of the Church of England. It says a whole lot about the incredible lack of confidence that the Church of England must have in its own role, in its own truth claims, in its own very important role in shaping British society. It says a whole lot about how secularized Great Britain has become, where you're talking about less than 1 in 10 attending church services weekly, far less, far, far less than you would find in the norm in the United States. You're talking about a society that is cutting itself off from its own roots, what Elton Trueblood called a cut flower civilization. What's left is the flower, but cut off from its roots, it is destined to wither and to die. Another very interesting thing in all this, of course, is the fact that Rowan Williams is a Christian theologian, and one who had a very liberal reputation when he was appointed and then confirmed by the approval of the Queen as the Archbishop of Canterbury, the head of the Church of England. He, as a liberal Christian theologian, is not tied to an understanding of biblical authority that would make him assume that there is a Muslim equivalent in terms of their understanding of the Quran. Now, I have in my hands right now a huge book, and when I say huge, I really mean huge. This book is by Hans Küng, a Roman Catholic who is a theologian. The book is about 700 pages long. It's entitled Islam, Past, Present, and Future. Now, Hans Küng is himself a very interesting figure. He is a very liberal Catholic theologian. As a matter of fact, he was so liberal and is so liberal that he was removed from his status as an official Catholic theologian by an action of the Vatican. That made him a cause celeb, a man of some fame in more liberal circles, where Hans Küng is exactly the kind of theologian they would prefer. But in this work, and first of all, it's interesting, of course, that a Christian theologian would write something like a 700-page work on Islam, past, present, and future. But what's interesting is, as I've looked carefully at this book, the way he sees forward is to suggest that what needs to happen in Islam is what he suggests has happened and is happening in Christianity. That is, we get over certain ideas to which we had formerly been committed. Ideas such as the absolute inspiration of Scripture. ideas such as that biblical authority should establish the truth claims, the convictions, and the expectations and the message of the church. In other words, if Muslims could just learn from Christians how to relate to their own claim of a sacred book, then all could potentially be negotiated and all could be well. Now, the interesting thing here for me, too, is that I can see in Rowan Williams' speech a lot of dependence, if not directly, then indirectly, upon the argument of Hans Kung in this book. Because Hans Kung is making the argument that there is no one Sharia law and that Sharia law ought to be seen or capable of being seen as something that's applicable in a way that doesn't lead to the extremes that Rowan Williams talked about, but rather could be understood more about issues of brotherhood and peace, the generalities that virtually no one would reject. The problem is that the sources that Archbishop Rowan Williams cites very similarly, including Tariq Ramadan, are themselves Westerners, Western Muslims, who would be considered apostate by the vast majority of Muslims around the world. Now, I want to make a statement here, and I want to make it very carefully. But one of the problems we have in the media is that the media tends left. It tends to reflect a very narrow and thin slice of the population, an intellectual elite. That elite tends to talk within itself. In other words, you're more likely to have liberals in the United States talking to members of the liberal intelligentsia in other countries. You're more likely to have Christian liberals, and that means those committed to a liberal worldview whose particular background was Christian, who are talking to those who have a liberal worldview or part of this global intelligentsia whose background happens to be Muslim. Tariq Ramadan, for instance, is an example of a Muslim who's like that. And Rowan Williams is an example of a Christian who's like that. And so when they talk about or are dependent in their writings in a conversation about something like Sharia law, they're just not talking about what most Muslims around the world would recognize as Sharia law. Nor are they talking about something that most of us within evangelical Christianity would recognize as biblical Christianity. I want us to hear once again from Rowan Williams, as Rowan Williams here, the Archbishop of Canterbury, is making what he attempted to present as a clarification of his argument, speaking to his own church's general synod.
So the question remains of whether certain additional choices could and should be made available under the law of the United Kingdom for resolving disputes and regulating transactions. It would be analogous to what's already possible in terms of the legal recognition of certain kinds of financial transactions under Islamic regulation, including special provision around mortgage arrangements, for example. And it would create a helpful interaction between the courts and the practice of Muslim legal scholars.
Now, one of the interesting things we need to clarify here is that we as Christians in the United States are not calling for a theocracy. We're not calling for the rule of biblical law and all its statutes and commands as backed up by the civil courts. We're not praying or asking also for separate enclaves in which we can apply that law parallel to the civil law. That is what's being proposed in Great Britain, but not on the part of Christians, but of Muslims. You know, we sometimes wonder how Western civilization really begins to implode. Here's a clear exhibition of just what that looks like. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Miller Program. Further evidence of just what happens when a Western society turns in on itself. A report here that comes from Religion News Service that an Anglican bishop has been ordered to pay a homosexual man about $92,000 in compensation for refusing to hire him because of his sexuality. Reading here from the report, John Reaney accused Hereford Bishop Anthony Prittis of discrimination, quote, on grounds of sexual orientation in blocking his appointment as a Hereford Diocese youth officer nearly 2 years ago. An employment tribunal awarded the compensation and ordered the bishop to undergo equal opportunity training. Reaney, who testified that the bishop questioned him about a homosexual relationship before telephoning 3 days later to reject his application, insisted that lesbian and gay Christians working within the Church of England are entitled to be treated with humanity. In his appearance before the tribunal, the bishop claimed that Reaney's sexual behavior was contrary to official church teaching, something that had, quote, the potential to impact on the spiritual, moral, and ethical leadership within the diocese. Folks, if you wonder what's possible out there, this isn't something far, far away from us. This is England. This is a bishop of the Church of England who has been found guilty by an employment tribunal of discriminating against a man because of his homosexuality. This is a bishop who's been required now to pay $92,000 in compensation to a homosexual man he prevented from being a youth worker within his diocese. This is a bishop of the Church of England who has now been ordered to undergo equal opportunity training. Sound like Brave New World? 1984? This is 2008 in Great Britain. Meanwhile, in the Netherlands, Catholics have rebranded the Lent fast as a Christian Ramadan in order to appeal to young people in the Netherlands, after all, who are more likely to know about Islam than Christianity. All these things tell us something about where we now stand. And when we start looking at this, we realize that what's happened in the Netherlands, what has happened in several of the neighborhoods of Paris, what has happened in many of the cities of Great Britain could happen here. The intellectual elite, in terms of its absolute worldview of tolerance, finds itself in a double bind here because they do not want to tolerate all that this means, but they've committed themselves to tolerate anything. Finally, as the program comes to an end today, I want to tell you about two 10-year-old boys in Indiana who got their tongues stuck to a frozen flagpole while imitating a scene from the movie A Christmas Story. Gavin Dempsey, age 10, said, "I decided to try it because I thought all the TV shows were lies. It turns out I was wrong." No, Gavin, every once in a while, what you see on television is true. That's a humbling reality. Back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.